The following podcast contains explicit language.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
Leave my sister and my daughter!
Rosebud.
What's in the box?
And like that, he's gone.
Hello, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Star Wars The Last Jedi, the exciting new installment in the Star Wars franchise. Is it number 7? Is that correct?
Eight.
Number 8. Star Wars number 8. I can't keep my numbers straight. So I'm joined here in the Slate studio by Sam Adams, who is Slate's browbeat editor and general culture writer extraordinaire. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
And by Forrest Wickman, Slate's culture editor. Hey, Forrest.
Hey, Dana.
So we have a lot to talk about here. I feel like we're taking on a heavy burden of history. The mantle, the cloak of Star Wars sits heavy around our shoulders. I guess I'll start with you, Sam, because you wrote the review for this, to my endless rage, because Forrest and I were shut out of a screening on Monday night that I was supposed to review. But I got a lot out of your review, and I'm really glad that you reviewed it. And so I will start with you and ask you, just for your quick thumbnail response, were your expectations fulfilled? In general, would you send people to this movie?
Yeah, it was kind of the movie critic equivalent of the chorus girl twisting her ankle.
Yeah. yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah, and you were Ruby Keeler coming in and saving the show.
I've always wanted to be Ruby Keeler, so this works out really well.
But you have to marry Al Jolson now.
Oh, well, you know, I knew what I was getting into. I loved it a lot. I mean, there's a stretch in the middle where I kind of lost track of the plot and was like, wait, where did Luke go again? But I mean, it's just, as I wrote in the review, it starts off with this very funny exchange, between Poe and Hux, that's almost like a kind of 2-minute like stand-up, you know, or kind of like sketch comedy routine right at the beginning of the movie. And it's just, you know, sometimes movies present you with a moment where you're kind of in or out, and that was just, you're either going to go with it at that point or you want. And I just went with it and kind of, you know, fell in love with that. I think it's got a great sense of humor. It has, I think, more, you know, striking imagery than any of the movies in the series. Some of the prequels are pretty striking visually, whatever their narrative flaws. But I think this is like the kind of fight in Snoke's throne room and things like that are just, you know, you don't come out of a Star Wars movie really talking about the images and the kind of, you know, set design and the fight choreography and things. And those are the things more than kind of what's happening with Luke and Rey. Those are the things that really excited me about this. And just having it hit me on that unexpected register was really kind of a thrill.
Yeah. All right. We will get to that and to who Poe and Hux are and what the funny exchange is. But first I'll go to Forrest and say, what about you, Forrest? Was there in general, because there's a lot of hype around this movie, right, that it was going to be sort of the greatest Star Wars movie since the original trilogy. Did you come out feeling disappointed, hopeful?
Yeah, I tried so hard and so consciously to try to reduce my expectations about this movie, but I also, like, you know, edited Sam's great and extremely glowing review coming in, and I lost the expectations game a little bit for about the first 2/3, I would say. I loved it, but I do think it takes its time to get to the fireworks factory. And once it gets there, you know, boom. But I thought it was like a
please
little
note,
slower.
There is no literal fireworks factory. That was a metaphor. Yeah, I guess, I mean, because it was Rian Johnson, we haven't mentioned his name yet, but I mean, really, it's his name and his history as a director that I think had so many people, including cinephiles who aren't necessarily Star Wars heads, like me, excited about this new installment and making us think that it would be something more than what I would say The Force Awakens was, the last real Star Wars episode in 2015, which was like a very competently done extension of the franchise, but did feel like it had, I don't know, that it had the mark of the brand more than the mark of the auteur on it.
I mean, the original is like, or Force Awakens is pretty much a remake of A New Hope. And I think, yeah, probably all of us were more anticipating this movie than The Force Awakens since The Force Awakens even came out. That's how
I felt.
Can
you remind people what A New Hope is if they're like me and they can't keep straight the new names that were attached to the...
A New Hope is Episode 4, aka the original Star Wars.
Right. A New Hope is basically Star Wars that you went to see, you know, in 1976, if you were alive like I was.
Yeah, I mean, I think when they announced J.J. Abrams for The Force Awakens, it was kind of course. You know, he has been, for better or for worse, kind of the he is the keeper of the flame for geek culture now. He's kind of who, you know, Hollywood calls, you know, when Joss Whedon isn't picking up his phone. You know, when they said Rian Johnson was doing Episode 8, that was really, there was nothing in his film history to suggest that he was interested in or would even necessarily be good at something like this, other than that he had made a bunch of kind of interesting movies, but he had never done something that was driven by action. He'd never done something in this kind of, you know, space opera, sci-fi fantasy register.
I guess you could say Looper is mildly driven by action, but yeah, it's still in the indie auteur zone. It's nothing near. I mean, if you just look at the length of the credits at the end of this movie, the man was managing an army in various different countries.
Right. So it was really just, you know, it was like, I mean, it was a big question mark, but it was a really interesting choice. And I think it kind of, you know, led us, you know, me to hope at least there would be something in this that wasn't like the other movies. And I think that, you know, there are definitely parts in the middle where the gears kind of grind, and it obviously has a lot of beats it has to hit. In a third movie, it has to set up in a giant commercial franchise it needs to protect. But I think within those confines, it does a lot of things that I was not expecting.
Well, as you say in your review, I mean, it's like The Empire Strikes Back in the sense that it's a middle movie, right? It begins in a place of failure and a place where the resistance is facing huge odds, and it doesn't necessarily conquer all of those odds by the end of the movie.
No, and I think it has what I think of now as a Two Towers problem, which is, if you remember the Lord of the Rings movie, the Two Towers, there's a you know, so many plot threads to keep track of in that movie. There's a lot of characters that they have to get from, I guess, B to C by the end of it. And two of them, Pippin and Merry, spend, I think, two-thirds of the movie just traveling on the back of an ant. Like, it's like, cut back to them, and they're still walking through the forest, and then cut back to them 20 minutes later, and they're still walking through the forest. And there's a thread in this movie involving a resistance ship just traveling in a straight line for about an hour and a half of screen time, and that's very much like the Pippin and Merry of this movie. Like, it's up, they check back in, they moved a little farther in space. And that's, you know, that's the part of it that I found, like, a little bit dull. You know, like, the plot was not the thing that kept me engaged in this movie.
Well, let's break down what some of these stories are, the various, you know, the various things that Johnson is intercutting between as he brings everyone together in this movie. As you say, at the beginning, we encounter Poe Dameron, the character played by Oscar Isaac, who, I have to say, one of my big complaints about The Force Awakens was, I want more Poe Dameron, and this movie delivers on that front because he becomes a much more major character.
Yeah, so the basic setup at the beginning, we start out with the Resistance kind of under siege. It's basically, all of the Resistance is crammed into this one spaceship, which the First Order has somehow found and is threatening. And there is the possibility that the entire Resistance could be wiped out in one fell swoop. So that's kind of the core of it, is what's going to happen to what remains of the Resistance. And around that, there are built several plots, including what's happening with Rey and Luke, if she's going to kind of pull him out of retirement for one last big score. Finn and a new character, Rose, played by Kelly Marie Tran, are sent on what kind of amounts to a fetch quest to go and find some master codebreaker so they can, you know, break onto the ship and disable their hyperspace tracking or something. But it all kind of revolves around this idea of whether the Resistance is going to survive and whether there will, in fact, be a new hope.
And let's talk also about, let's just remind everyone who the bad guys are at this point, because I had sort of forgotten who was in the throne of evil.
Yeah, I mean, so this movie does something very similar to what Empire Strikes Back did, which is that, like, we have Kylo Ren, played by Adam Driver, who was kind of the Vader figure, but then this brings in more this character, Snoke, Supreme Leader Snoke, who was kind of just like a fuzzy hologram in the previous movie, but now we, you know, see him in the flesh, and he's voiced by Andy Serkis. Very, very well. I mean, this is like a tough role to take on. I think that, like, the just, you know, completely 100% cardboard evil character, like the devil of the movie. But I thought Andy Serkis, like, does it about as well as you could do it.
I mean, he does a good voice, but I have to say that I was not that impressed by Snoke as written, I guess. There's not enough backstory for us to know why everybody is bending the knee before this kind of crumpled old guy in a throne.
Yeah, I mean, like, his character is very much just like Emperor Palpatine redux, and doesn't really bring much new to that. Like, the Kylo Ren villain is super interesting because he's this conflicted character. He's kind of like a fan of Vader in a way that, like, makes him relatable to some section of the audience. So Kylo Ren is super interesting, and I feel like I don't think Snoke really brings anything new that we didn't already see with the Emperor.
And then Donald Gleason is probably the bad guy you see the most of. He's Hux. Is that the character's name?
Although, can I ask, was Oscar Isaac deliberately saying Admiral Hugs when he was trolling Hux throughout the first scene? Because I thought maybe he was, and I love that. In my head, he will always be saying, like, Admiral Hux will always be Admiral Hugs
it's
from
like,
now on.
Like lots of hugging bear.
Yeah, or but, it makes me think of, like, Teddy Ruxpin or something. Yeah, I mean, he's just not as scary as he wants to be, which this movie really underlines in a very funny way.
Well, but now we've mentioned it twice, so we have to just briefly discuss that trolling moment that the movie starts with, which you, Sam, compared to Spaceballs in your review.
Yeah, so basically what happens is, you know, the First Order is getting ready to, you know, I think they're going to descend on some planet or something and attack it. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. Okay. They're going after the rebel base, which is on this planet.
Yes,
yeah.
There's so many rebel bases. So we start out with the First Order about to descend on a planet that has this rebel base, and they're expecting some big counterattack from the Resistance, and instead this one ship shows up with Poe Dameron behind it, and Hux in particular is just so confused by this that he's temporarily kind of wrong-footed, and then he has some big kind of blood and thunder speech that he's going to tell Poe Dameron, kind of get him quaking in his boots. And Poe Dameron just keeps acting like he doesn't hear him and messing up his rhythm and saying, like, oh, no, I'm sorry, I'm holding for General Hux. No, I'm still holding for General Hux. And Hux is just so thrown by this because he's got this big, scary thing that he wants to say. And instead, it's like his mic isn't working, that he just completely undercut by it. And it is this very, reminded me of like Darth Helmet in Spaceballs, where he's just trying to put up this front and nobody else is buying it. And he just is lost.
Jammed. Strawberry.
Yeah.
It is a great beginning because it establishes, you know, it establishes the sort of endearingness of the Resistance, right? It brings us onto their side just because they're funny and they're witty and they are scrappy with whatever little bit that they have. And to me, it also makes me feel okay that Han Solo is gone, because it's sort of like Poe is going to take over, right? He's going to be the wisecracking daredevil flyboy pilot that we no longer have.
It is the leather jacket.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is very much a riff on that kind of like, you know, everything's okay here, like moment from the first movie when Han is kind of, you know, when Han is kind of delaying the stormtroopers on the other end. So it is sequel wise a little bit of a riff on that, but it also has this very almost distractingly kind of modern. It's like almost like a voicemail joke or something. And
you're right, it's a post internet kind of joke. But that makes me want to make a broader observation about humor in this movie, which I was pleased about. And I remember walking in with you last night, Forrest. I was saying, is it going to have fourth wall breaking, you know, self-aware sort of snarky moments, and it really doesn't. And it is a pretty sincere, you know, it's a sincere self-contained universe that's not trying to wink at us for knowing about previous Star Wars history. And I like that.
Yeah, I think it like nails that aspect of the kind of Star Wars voice very well, which is that it's very sincere, but also like deeply goofy. And like the goofiness is where the humor comes from, more so than the like in jokes.
Right.
Though there are some of those. The Poe Dameron opening sequence, though I found it like a little too similar to the kind of Death Star trench run from the original. Like it was one of the moments in the movie where it was like, you kind of did this before. But it does set up his character arc. In addition to kind of introducing this swaggering guy, it also sets up like maybe he's a little too reckless. And then the movie, I think, does a very good job of spending the rest of the runtime nailing down this theme of, you know, it's more important to, I forget exactly how Rose frames it, but it's something like it's more important to save what you love than to destroy what you hate or something. And this is kind of the first example of that, right? Like Poe Dameron puts all of his comrades in danger by like going after this extra guard tower.
Right. And so establishing him as a hothead also sets up an important conflict later on in the movie between him and Laura Dern's character. I can't remember her rank now. Her name is Holdo, but is she a general?
She's
is she
a vice
colonel?
Admiral?
Yes, she is a vice admiral.
Okay.
An admiral of vice, yes.
And she is running the big resistance ship that you were talking about slowly plotting across the galaxy, correct?
Yeah.
And so later on, there's going to be a confrontation, almost a Kirk Spock-style confrontation between Poe Dameron and her about whether to use more hot-headed methods or to sort of hold back and be more strategic.
Right. And that conflict starts with Leia. So Leia, Vice Admiral Holdo, and Rose, the Kelly Marie Tran character, are like these three women who had all at some point in the movie tell some hot-headed male character that like they need to cool it.
Right.
Which is... you know, one of the big themes.
Yeah. And all three of them are right. I mean, it's a pretty, it's in terms of being like a pretty feminist and multicultural movie, I think it nails that without being up on its high horse about it.
Yeah. I mean, right down to the extras, we had a really interesting post from our editorial assistant, Marissa Martinelli, after Rogue One about how, you know, Rogue One was the second Star Wars movie in a row that had this great female hero at the center of it. But weirdly, all of the shots in the background, when it was just like the random resistance fighters, it was just like pretty much all white men. And in this movie, it's like a complete switch on that, where whenever they show pretty much any pilot or any random soldier who's charging into battle, it's like almost never a white man.
Yeah, there's that classic sequence at the beginning when Poe is doing his raid on the, I guess, the First Order dreadnought, it is, or the and, you know, there's that classic Star Wars thing where it cuts between all the people in their cockpits. And, you know, if you, that sequence in, you know, the original Star Wars is just white guy after white guy, then alien, and then white guy. And it's really striking in this one how it is, you know, woman, person of color, alien, then I think there's one white guy in there, you know, but it's just those, the sequence of those shots is really such a capsule illustration of how much this franchise and the culture it exists in has changed.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
As long as we're talking about big, kind of familiar beats, one of the other big plot lines here is, you know, Rey going to meet Luke, and then we sort of get like the Dagobah sequence that's very much like Empire Strikes Back, where it's all about her, her training. And like the Dagobah sequence in the original Empire Strikes Back is a little slow. It's the moment that everyone always falls asleep if they watch Empire Strikes Back, you know, after 7 p.m. I'm curious what you guys thought of it. I really liked it, but it's like a little slack, I think. Like, I don't know if we really needed the Jedi fishing.
Well, actually, that, I mean, that the very fact that Jedi training is not the most exciting thing to watch is sort of referenced in some of those scenes, because there's a moment, isn't there, when Luke says something like, I realize that these Jedi texts aren't exactly page turners.
Yeah. No. It's Yoda says it, and he says, page turners, they are not.
That's right.
Or something.
How could I
maybe
not have remembered the reversed syntax, page turners, they are not.
I mean, one of the things that this movie does very well that I like, obviously Luke was a very minor character in The Force Awakens. He shows up in the last scene, literally has no lines, although he still managed to be first billed. Good for Mark Hamill and his agent. But they really, you know, he has this great kind of weathered, you know, old kind of burned out quality in this that it reminded me a lot of, you know, sort of the Akira Kurosawa movies that inspired George Lucas when he was making the original movie. There's a moment, which I left out of the review, but I can talk about now, when, you know, that big moment built up to at the end of The Force Awakens, when Rey holds out Luke's lightsaber to him. And then we finally pick up with that in this thing, and Luke grabs it from her, kind of looks at it like it's a dead fish, and just chucks it over his shoulder. And that's like a pure Toshiro Mifune moment to me. It's so wonderful. And he has this kind of grizzled old drunk quality to him in this movie that I really like. I think the Jedi training stuff that's just with Rey, like when she goes down into that weird kind of, you know, seaweed cloaca or whatever it is,
has an interaction with like an infinite regression reflection of herself.
Yeah, that was a little, you know, I frankly kind of didn't really get what that was going after exactly. And that really did kind of slow down the progress a lot in the middle. But I like all the, I guess it's called Ochto, whatever the Skellig Michael Island stuff in this movie that where Luke is involved.
Wait, why is it called, when in the movie did they say it was called that? Or is that just part of deeper Star Wars lore that I don't know?
I don't know if it's in the movie. In my head, it's still just like the Skellig place, because that's where it was filmed, you know, in real life. I can't remember if they name it in the movie or not.
I don't think they do, but it's on Wikipedia.
Reliable source.
I'm so glad I have you here, Sam. Yeah. But, well, there is something about those scenes, and it happens, this becomes true later on when he sort of enters the fray as well, but there's something great about the fact that Luke, essentially in that, you know, broken down Toshiro Mifune mode, kind of admits that the Force hasn't gotten them all that far, right? I mean, there's a moment when he kind of says, you know, this hasn't really worked yet, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, and I think we really needed that, because one of the problems with The Force Awakens, I mean, you have to, you know, restart the trilogy, one of the problems with The Force Awakens, I mean, you have to restart the story, but it really undermines the end of the first trilogy, because it's like, oh, they beat the Empire. And then it's like, oh, it's like 10 years later and they're back. And so it's like, well, they're really not very good at like defeating the Empire. They keep coming back, and it really kind of needed Luke to acknowledge that their track record is not good.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, especially in this moment in history. I mean, obviously this movie went into preparation before the election, but it made me wonder the script and that kind of insistence on the failure of the resistance and yet the nobility of keeping going really did make me think of our political moment now. It was impossible not to think of it. Is it possible that any of this stuff was scripted after the election?
So I had the same exact reaction. I mean, really throughout the movie, from the opening credits where it says the resistance fighters, you know, fighting against the rise of a new tyranny, to like the last shot of the movie is like a total shout out to the resistance. So I looked it up afterwards. This movie finished filming before, or at least principal photography before the election. So I think it's all a coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was completed, like done in May or around then, which was the original release date. But it's been done for 6 months. So,
something similar happened with Rogue One, the previous Star Wars movie that was, written and filmed completely before the election, but came out only 2 months after the election. And everyone was like, wow, this feels like so timely. And I think it's just, you know, the Star Wars movies have. Well, the original trilogy and now this trilogy are all about rebel fighters, and it just gets a little bit of extra oomph from that, even though I think it's basically, you know, incidental.
Right.
I mean, it is a reminder that the Trump era just kind of, you know, supersized this tendency that was already in the culture well beforehand. I mean, some of what these movies come out of, I think, is the idea that, you know, for, you know, 16 years now, we've been, you know, fighting a war on terror, and you can't really beat kind of an existential quality. And so, yeah, of course, they don't defeat evil, because there's always going to be evil, and it just rises again in new forms. And it is a perpetual struggle.
All right. Well, one of the big set pieces in the middle of the movie that recalls in a wonderful way the great Mos Eisley bar sequence in the first in A New Hope, the original Star Wars, is the trip that Finn and Rose, John Boyega and Kelly Marie Tran, make to the planet of Cantonica. I just got this from Sam's Voyages Through Wikipedia.
Isn't it like the third day of Cantonica right now?
The advent calendar is up. So they visit the city of Cantobite on the planet of Cantonica, which is apparently some sort of intergalactic gambling center. It's like a casino planet. And do you want to take that away for us?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things to talk about here. I think the first one is, you know, what does this do for the plot? They're supposed to be recruiting a master codebreaker so that they can break into the Star Destroyer and then disable its trackers so that they can jump to light speed without being tracked through the jump to light speed, which ends up just being a total like loose end and red herring, right? In a kind of interesting way, but I feel like this is an example of the slackness in the middle of the movie.
Don't get quite why they're there, but it doesn't really matter.
Well, we understand why we're there. It just, they fail, and then it ends up being irrelevant, right?
What is that little golden dice thing? Is that the code breaker? That thing that people are carrying around that looks like two pieces of gold dice?
I can recommend you to a post on the Slate site right now, which is an explainer of what the space dice are, which is they're Han Solo's dice. I don't think that totally lands either. I mean, clearly it didn't land for you, but essentially the idea is that Han Solo had two dice hanging like kind of from his rear view mirror in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon. But they're pretty much invisible in all of the previous movies and might not even be there in some of the movies. And so it's basically just this symbol of the legacy of Han Solo, and that's a nice thought, but I feel like maybe they could have come up with a better image than these space dice that no one had ever thought about in their lives before. Right.
They should have been fuzzy dice, then we would know they were hanging from his rearview mirror.
Yeah.
I mean, I do like when they, you know, the idea is they're searching for this master codebreaker there, and when they get there, he'll have some, you know, flower in his lapel. And there's one shot of him, and he's kind of elegantly made up man who I didn't even recognize Justin Theroux, but apparently it's Justin Theroux.
I didn't either.
Yeah, I had to read the credits. But yeah, so Ed with his flower and his lapel, and then they just can't get to him, and then they find, you know, not the master code breaker, but a master code breaker played by Benicio del Toro. And that's, there are some great kind of fun unmyth making moments in the movie that are sort of a little parallel to like the marketplace fight in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where, you know, Harrison Ford just shoots the swordsman instead of fighting him. And it's a little bit like that, like, yeah, there's the master code breaker, but we can't get to him, so let's just find some other guy.
Yeah. And the fact that the person that they pick up is a mercenary, right? Benicio del Toro plays someone who will sell information or assistance to whichever side needs it. And that brings in something that you don't often see in the Star Wars universe, which is somebody who's neither on the side of good or evil, but who is sort of a merchant in between.
Yeah. I mean, that's the best part about this sequence is not only how it introduces nuance, like the idea that there are these war profiteers who kind of fight for neither side in particular, or sell their weapons to neither side in particular, but also just like a class consciousness. Like, I'm pretty sure this is the first Star Wars movie, as far as I can remember, that really has a class consciousness. So, you know, it's all these super rich people who are just gambling away their money in the casinos. And then we also meet these kind of like Dickensian chimney sweeps who are just these like street urchins who are sweeping up the city of Canto Bite.
Well, there's also just a beautiful, I mean, just for art direction and production design, that scene kind of rules. There's a great sort of, I guess it's just like a tracking shot moving slowly through the entire casino and just showing sort of Mos Eisley style all the various weird, you know, noodle-headed creatures at the gaming tables.
Yeah, that is actually, I believe, a reference to the 1927 silent film Wings. I think, I mean, it's this movie is really kind of loaded with references. I mean, that which is a really... You know,
you mean, and because there's a camera that moves through a casino in
yes,
a similar
yeah,
way?
There's a very kind of famous similar shot from that. And it's, you know, it's interesting that it, I mean, it's not only because all the, you know, Star Wars movies are referency, but that it's kind of taking its cues from things kind of outside of geek culture, which is not something that's necessarily been common in a lot of the other movies.
Yeah, that was the first Academy Award Best Picture, right? Wings in 1927.
Yep,
Clara
yep.
Bow.
Gary Cooper, his like star-making moment.
I don't think I've ever seen Wings. Have you guys seen it?
I've just seen that shot primarily in GIF form.
Oh, I need to see Wings now. You can't see the reference 80 years later or whatever without seeing the movie.
Well, there's another reference for that sequence, too, that Sam, you flagged for me that in the credits, they credit the Long Goodbye John Williams song from the, you know, 70s Altman movie. And I'm pretty sure that it plays. I guess we should back up briefly to set up some plot, but basically there are like these horse races on the planet of Canto Bite that everybody bets on, and then Rose and Finn free the horses, and
but they're really cool weird giant space horses that look sort of like giraffes.
They're kind of like Tauntauns from The Empire Strikes Back a little bit. They kind of run more on their back legs, I think. But anyway, as they like then stampede through the casino, there's this shot of like a kind of a tea saucer or something, and you get like this music that's playing in the casino, and that's the Long Goodbye theme, I'm pretty sure.
Thank you. Because I saw that in the credits and I did not spot it, and the Long Goodbye is like one of my favorite movies ever, and it's, you know, John Williams kind of stealing his own score from that movie, but I felt kind of a little flabbergasted that I missed a reference to that. So
it's pretty brief.
So once they get off of the planet, what else do we need to cover in this? It's a 152 long minute movie, although it doesn't feel terribly long when you're watching it. So we have a lot of story still to tell.
Well, I mean, from there, I guess we basically just get everybody back together. So everyone ends up back on the rebel ship, and then they're trying to escape on their escape pods, and those start getting shot down, and then there's a big loss, and then everybody ends up back on this, I don't know what it is, it's like a salt mine planet, and that gives us what I would say is the best sequence in the movie. We get this battle on this salt planet where whenever they run over the ground, it kicks up this red, I guess it's the dust under the salt. Was that you guys'
Yeah, beautiful art direction. I mean, this is, going in, I had heard people tweeting and talking about, oh, there's one sequence that everyone's going to talk about. And even if you don't love the rest of the movie, it's going to be the one. And I still don't know what it was. But for me, I think it would probably be everything that happens on the salt planet. Do you think that would probably be the popular reference for the thing everyone loves?
I think that and the throne room fight that I mentioned right. earlier are really mm-hmm. the two striking things, both built around the color red. But I love there is a shot in this where the First Order, you know, commander or whatever is kind of, he's got his men in the trenches, and then he steps out onto the surface and there's this red streak, and they actually put in a shot where one guy for some reason puts his finger to it and licks it and goes salt, and it's like, I'm just explaining to you why everything is about to start kicking up these huge plumes of red dust, which are really there just because they look cool, but like, here's our vague like rationale for why that happens.
Yeah. But of course that moment is also a little bit like the moment in Prometheus where the scientist dies because he just decides to grab with his bare hand some sort of never before seen creature on an alien planet. Like, you're really going to lick your finger and just taste the dust on a planet you've never been to before?
Well, the other reason for that shot is that it's the cameo for Gareth Edwards, the director of Rogue One, who's, I don't think he's the guy that says the thing about salt, but he's the guy who kind of like looks at him and kind of nods.
Ah, salt, you say. But yeah, that planet does look spectacular. And in those scenes, there's several big fight scenes involving various technologies on this blood red salt planet. And that's where I really saw the Kurosawa references that you talk about in your review. And I don't know exactly what scene. I guess it would be something from Ron or from Throne of Blood, yeah, but
there's a scene, there's a sequence in Ron kind of late in the movie. I think it's right after the first gunshot is fired, and suddenly you've heard all these battle sounds and suddenly goes quiet. And there are these kind of color-coded red and yellow armies from both sides, and they just come pouring down towards each other, and it's like these two rivers of paint are colliding, and so there's these moment where the resistance ships are kind of approaching this big, I believe it's called a battering ram cannon, because I guess they couldn't come up with a better name for it. They'd used up all their cool names on planets. But where they have to put down their skids or something, so because they're old, and so they're all, you know, kicking up these straight lines of red dust as they're heading towards this thing and just kind of tracing this.
Well, it's more like, it's almost more like a layer of white salt on top of a red ground, right? So there has to be this kind of unscraping. It's like that paper that you scrape a drawing into, you know? It's a really, really cool effect.
So we've talked about that as like the one great battle sequence in this movie. And then there's the great, you know, kind of the great lightsaber confrontation that's in the throne room that we keep kind of teasing and never getting to, which we have to talk about.
We do have to talk about. I feel much less strongly about that than the blood red throne. Like, I have to say that I've sort of felt, maybe it's because I just don't care about Snoke that much. I really don't quite understand. It's not like Darth Vader where you understand the evil that he's been invested with or sort of what his cult personality is about or something like that. He just seemed like a sitting duck waiting to be slaughtered. But go ahead and tell me why the throne room scene is great.
Well, I will say I did hear you, Dana, at the exact moment that the blue lightsaber ignites and goes, you know, impales Snoke, I kind of heard you like, yeah, or something.
Oh, yeah, the way he dies is very satisfying and sort of comic. There's something, in fact, it may be a reference to some, it seems to me like a reference to some martial arts movie that I probably don't know, but the way that he's sort of severed and half on the throne and half of him falls off the throne very neatly. And then much later when Hux or somebody, not some other evil person, goes in to investigate, the second half of him falls off the throne.
I mean, to quote Walk Hard, it is one of the worst cases of being cut in half I've ever seen.
But other than the satisfyingly comic slicing of Snoke, what was it that made that scene so special?
I mean, I think there's like a number of great twists in it. There's a number of great twists in it, and B, it has some pretty good fight choreography and looks cool. But I'm curious to hear Sam on this, because it seems like maybe it's your favorite sequence in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, in a word, red. Mm-hmm. It's just this incredible kind of, you know, whatever scarlet on garnet palette to it or something. You've got this kind of blood red throne room with these red First Order guards in the back. And it's just like astonishing to look at in a way that these movies so rarely are. And then there's a bit after the end, after the fighting has concluded and you know, grand Star Wars tradition, they've completely wrecked the room around them as well. And Kylo Ren is kind of making his pitch to Rey to kind of join him, basically like Vader does at the end of Empire, saying, you know, join me, like we can rule the galaxy together. And there's this kind of, you know, flaming debris raining down in the background behind him. And it's like just those visuals were so startling to me. And I do think they find, you know, every one of the guards has their own little separate weapon and their own kind of interesting way of fighting. And that, you know, that's really kind of interesting and involving to me. But, you know, so much of it is just the look of it. And you know, I'm just sitting there watching a Star Wars movie going, wow, this looks amazing.
Yeah, it does have beautiful visual imagination, that scene. But we can't talk about that scene without talking about Kylo Ren's moral flip-flopping and his incredible waffling in between good and evil throughout this movie. And maybe part of why that scene was less than dramatically compelling to me is that We just watched him supposedly kind of be won over to the good side, or at least to open up some avenue of trust toward Ray, right, in the previous scene. And then suddenly we don't know, is he flip-flopping because he just likes evil again, or was he faking it the whole time?
Well, so, I mean, there are just a number of twists in this scene. And I think, yes, initially you think he's flip-flopped, as you put it. And then after he gives this pitch to Ray, you realize, oh, he seems to have had this other plan all along.
To just usurp the throne from Snoke.
Right. Which is, yeah, he just wanted to kill off his master so he could take control himself. I think he's a complicated character. I suspect that to some extent both of those things were going on in him at the same time, but I don't think that they're entirely contradictory. I don't think it was like a flip-flop one way and then a flip-flop back. I think he maybe didn't want to kill Rey, A, and B, does have this, you know, total thirst for raw power is the phrase that keeps being repeated in this movie. And so both of those things lead him to kill Snoke and then try to recruit Rey. And we have to talk about the nature of him and Rey's relationship now, which is the biggest spoiler in the movie is who are Rey's parents? Like, is Rey Kylo Ren / Ben Solo's like twin or sister? Sam, you said something earlier that makes me think that you might have had a slightly different interpretation of this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Kylo Ren says, you know, Rey, search your feelings. And just as it's the same as in Empire Strikes Back, where Darth Vader is trying to get Luke to join him to rule the galaxy and then reveals who Luke's father is. Kylo is kind of trying to use this revelation to recruit her. And then she says, you know, my parents were nobody. And then he seemingly reveals that, like, they were retrieved and sold trash and sold her away or something.
It just sounds like they were losers. It doesn't he even imply that they sold her for, I don't know, because of some addiction?
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, and within the Star Wars universe, that's a pretty incredible revelation, because when you find out who your parents are in the Star Wars universe, they better be some, you know, noble galaxy changing figure. Like, that actually gives her this great, to me, even more sort of nobility, because she's risen from nothing to be a fighter for good.
Yeah. And I mean, and there's also this question of, like, can you have the Force if your parents weren't, like, part of the line of people that have the Force, which
right.
In the prequels, it's like there's actually these things in your blood called midichlorians that explain it. And the movies have been really trying to get away from that. I mean, Sam, did you take
Kylo
Ren?
Ooh, that's so creepy. I never got that because I haven't seen all three of those bad
interstitial movies. I mean, it's like one of the most notorious details about the prequels.
Ooh,
yeah.
That's really creepy.
Did you take Kylo Ren and Rey at their word?
I guess I did. Should I not have?
Oh, no. I wondered if you didn't. I mean, I basically take them at their word, though. I do wonder if we'll hear more about Rey's parents in the next one. I mean, I'm sort of left wondering. I think it's really cool that there's this idea that, you know, maybe anyone can get the Force and rise to be this great hero. But I am sort of left wondering why Rey has been perceived as special throughout this whole movie and the one that came before it.
It'll be interesting to see if they explain that or not, because one of the problems with The Force Awakens is that, you know, of course Kylo Ren ends up being Han and Leia's son because, you know, Luke was Vader's son, and it's kind of, you know, overdrawn parallelism. It's this kind of overdrawn parallelism to the previous movies to the point where, you know, everything is completely unsurprising because it's just kind of running in the same tracks and just kind of building up this chosen one mythology around Rey and then completely undercutting it and being like, actually, your parents were nobody. You're just like a regular person is a really kind of interesting twist.
I mean, you could sort of say that that's where sci-fi is going these days, that there's a little bit of an anti-chosen one movement, right? It happens in Blade Runner 2049. And in a more comic register, it happens in the Lego movie. You know, I mean, it sort of takes apart the idea of there being this one dynastic chosen one.
Yeah, I mean, and to state the obvious, it's just like a deeply conservative idea that, like, the only way you can be special is if you were born into nobility, and I'm really tired of that.
Yeah, well, and like you say, I mean, starting to question that also opens up the question of class in this movie that hasn't really happened in previous Star Wars. All right, there's so many threads still to wrap up here in this movie, but two really important characters we haven't talked that much about are Luke and Leia. When we've talked about Luke in relation to, you know, the lessons that he's giving, what's it called? Dagobah? What's the
Dagobah? The Dagobah system.
which is basically the teaching method of the Fours.
No. Sorry, the Dagobah system is so Dagobah is like the swamp place where Luke, is given his Jedi training in The Empire Strikes Back. So it's not a system; it's a place.
Okay. All right. So it's the interchange between them that you mean. So that we've sort of talked about, but we haven't really talked about Luke's final fate in the movie and the last we see of Mark Hamill, which is beautiful and also to me a bit confusing. So let's go over it, and I'll jump in and tell you the bit that I didn't get.
Yeah. I mean, so this is, to me, this was another one of the great like third act twists in this movie, and I sort of saw it coming, but it really worked for me. So, you know, during this big showdown between the First Order and the Rebellion, Luke sort of just appears, and he gets a nice kind of hello moment with Leia. You know, you changed your hair is what Leia thinks he's going to say, which is a good line. But then he just kind of steps out into the middle of this battlefield and, you know, lets them unleash all of their lets the First Order unleash all of their power on him. And when the dust clears, he's still standing. And then Kylo Ren comes out and they have a quick, lightsaber battle in which Kylo just can't like make contact with Luke. And also we get the moment of Luke brushing his shoulder off, which we have to shout out, which was like one of the more modern moments. It like felt slightly cheap to me, but also very funny, and I laughed a lot.
It's going to make a great GIF someday.
Oh, yes. what happens is we basically learn that Luke has somehow made a immaterial version of himself appear on that battlefield, and that's something that's a little bit set up by these sequences earlier in the movie where Rey and Kylo Ren kind of can see each other even though they're not actually in the same room. So I assume that Luke is using some version of that.
Psychic connection. But it hasn't previously been established. So here's the thing. So you're getting to the thing that I don't really get, which I thought maybe had been previously established in one of the movies I haven't seen, which I think are the second two after The Phantom Menace, whatever those two are.
Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the
At that point, as I was saying to Forrest the other night, I was not yet a movie critic, and my attitude was basically, why would I see a Star Wars movie if it's bad? I'm not going back to one of those. But is it established ever that controlling the Force really well, the way Luke does and Rey is learning to do, means that you can astrally project yourself into other places?
I don't think it's established in any of the movies. I wouldn't be surprised if it's in some of the books and stuff, which I don't know as well. I think, you know, as I say, I think it's sort of teased earlier in the movie. I think that the Star Wars movies are often sort of gradually introducing more Force powers. Like, we didn't know that Sith Lords or Sith Masters or whatever could shoot lightning from their fingers until Return of the Jedi, and that just suddenly happened, and it was, you know, whoa, didn't know they could do that. And I think it's a little... This is another example of that, where they kind of slowly develop it over the course of the movie. I don't understand the exact mechanics of how he does what he does, but the Force.
I mean, he seems to be kind of, you know, it's not clear if he's just kind of like hypnotizing everybody, if he's actually physically there. I mean, I think you do get the sense, because what happens to Luke at the end of the sequence is it cuts back to Ahch-To, and he just kind of vanishes out of
his
robe.
Well, he's like levitating in the lotus position, which is, you know, he's sort of like summoning all of his Jedi power, you imagine, to project this, I guess, fake Luke onto this other planet. Yeah. But that seems a bit odd because, well, I mean, I guess it's sort of more like an extension of him, right? But does that empty, for example, the emotional exchange that he had with his sister of its meaning because it was just like an astral projection that was having it?
Right. I mean, I guess the implication, though, would be like the reason we haven't seen this before is because it's sort of a last ditch. Like, you do this and then you use up all your physical energy and then you just vanish into the Force or whatever.
And the way he disappears, I mean, spoiler, you know, we lost Han Solo in the last one and we lose Luke at this moment, at his sort of, you know, greatest moment of victory. He just turns into a puff of smoke.
I mean,
disappears.
One of the lovely things about this movie is Rian Johnson said that he didn't alter it in any way after Carrie Fisher died. And you know, she's alive at the end of the movie. She had a substantial part to play in episode 9, or at least it was originally outlined. That's obviously not going to happen now, but the last moment between them, the last thing Luke says to her is, no one's ever really gone. And that is, in the context of the movie, that's about his imminent, you know, death or decorporealization or whatever it is, but it obviously has this other resonance you know, this being the last movie we're ever going to see Carrie Fisher in. I held it together emotionally better during her scenes than I thought I was going to. But that one was, I definitely kind of let loose at that moment.
So. Well, hearing them say goodbye at that moment. Yeah, exactly. It's sort of a double meaning. I mean, in the context of the movie, it just means like two of the three kind of original trio are gone. But of course, in our minds, we know, well, they're all three gone from the movies now.
Yeah. And I think there's still a chance we'll see Luke as a force ghost or something in episode 9, especially now that they're not going to have Leia. So.
I mean, but I have to say that scene, that goodbye, was very sad, and him disappearing in the puff was great. But not having had it established that this astral projection thing can happen, I didn't quite feel the energy that the crowd seemed to express at that moment that you realize that he wasn't really there on the blood red planet. I was just scratching my head.
Yeah, I think you could even trace it back as far as like the Jedi mind tricks in the first movie. Like in the first movie, we have the famous, you know, these are not the droids you're looking for, which is when we learned that Jedis can mess with people's minds. And it kind of builds from there through this weird thing where Snoke makes, we haven't even really talked about this, where Snoke makes Kylo Ren and Rey see each other and kind of feel like they're in the same place, even though they're not. And then it builds even further in this final scene. But I mean, it's true. It was slightly confusing to me in a way that maybe it could have been set up better in a way that would have made the twist hit even harder with more people. But like it worked for me.
I have to just throw in one thing about the psychic communications between Rey and Kylo Ren is that everybody loved and laughed at the scene where they enter into psychic communication at a moment when Adam Driver happens to be shirtless and looking
and
really buff.
Which we have to say, somebody in the theater that Dana and I were in, somebody in the back just went, a woman just went, whoa. And then everyone laughed because it like expressed exactly what everybody was thinking.
That was the one thing that I wanted to find in Porgs where like but I wanted to find a place for that in the review because I felt like that deserved mentioning, and it just I couldn't like build an entire paragraph around it, but I do think that is, you know, worth mentioning for a number of reasons.
Well, and it's interesting to think about in retrospect. I mean, I think at the time the movie really wants you to think that Rey and Kylo Ren are brother and sister, and so she's like, ew, put a shirt on because it's like, I don't want to see stupid sexy brother, you know? And then by the end of the movie, you realize that maybe the reason for this connection, well, we know that Snoke has been kind of manipulating them to make it happen, but like maybe there's an erotic charge between them, and that's part of what the connection is. And so now there's this sort of love triangle, I think, in a weird way between Rey and Finn, which we had in the first one, and Kylo Ren, with whom she shares a mysterious connection that doesn't seem to be familial and does seem to be erotic. And that's interesting to me and new for the Star Wars movies.
Right. Yeah, there's not a lot of romance. There's also a tiny little bit of a suggestion that Rose has a crush on Finn, right?
Yeah.
Because when he saves her life, she gives him a kiss on the lips. But yeah, in general, no, but there's not any romantic subplot in this movie. All right, something that we just mentioned in passing that we haven't gotten to yet at all, and that you didn't get to mention in your review, you said, Sam, is Porgs and cuteness and the state of creatures in the Star Wars universe. Do you want to address what is a Porg?
A Porg is, what have they been compared to? It's sort of like a hamster puffin type hybrid that lives on this rock that Luke is in, and then one of them basically hops aboard the Millennium Falcon and becomes sort of like Chewbacca's main scene partner in the movie, which is quite a strange development.
And he's never, the Porg, as far as I can tell, is never given a name, or we don't quite know how they communicate. He just makes little squawking sounds and looks adorable. Do you find them to just be sort of cute furniture, or is there any future for them as characters the way that Chewbacca has become a character?
Well, to me, the exact nature of the relationship is that like the Porg is Chewbacca's Chewbacca, right? Like Chewbacca was Han's Chewbacca, like the person who sat in the co-pilot's seat and made noises that like could be understood mysteriously between them, but didn't seem to be words. And now Chewbacca has a Chewbacca of his own in the form of a Porg.
But the Porg is not particularly cool headed. Like whenever the ship gets into trouble and is kind of, you know, experiencing turbulence, the Porg is basically plastered to the window, freaking out.
Right. Yeah. I was worried. I think a lot of people were torn between thinking they were super cute and worried that they might be cloying. And to me, that instantly, any fear I had that they would be cloying actually instantly went away when I saw them flying on the cliffs, because I instantly just realized, oh, they're the puffins of this planet, and puffins are exactly like that. Have you guys ever met puffins?
I've seen them in aquariums.
Yeah, well, I mean, in real life, they will just stand like feet from you. They're way too trusting, mm-hmm. and that makes them very easy to catch. And so, you know, Icelanders, for example, have eaten them for a long time, and they have to stop catching them. Anyway, the porgs are exactly like puffins in real life. It's like not exaggerated in the least. I guess their eyes are bigger, but that instantly kind of sold it for me.
Space puffins.
Yeah,
and we have the crystal foxes on the mining planet.
Oh yeah, those are good creatures.
Well, who are really pretty beautiful. They're like something out of like the Never Ending Story or something.
Right. They sort of look as if ice has frozen on all of their fur, but it's there all the time. And they're of course digitally rendered, but they're really beautiful and they seem to belong on that blood red planet. I hope some more stuff happens on that blood red planet in the future because it's got a really cool geology. All right. Speaking of the future of Star Wars, let's sign off by talking about what's coming up next. Like you mentioned Star Wars 9, what's on the slate for that movie? It's not going to be a Rian Johnson directed production, right?
No, they are after some turmoil going back with J.J. Abrams for that movie. I mean, the script is apparently still being written, so obviously nobody knows the plot yet. I mean, one of the interesting things about The Last Jedi is it's really a passing of the torch. I mean, we basically have, because of Carrie Fisher's death, I mean, the entire original trilogy of characters who were remaining are all kind of not going to be a factor in the movie. And it's really the torch and has really been passed to this newer, younger, more diverse cast of characters. And they're really going to have to step up and completely carry the story on their own. So obviously we don't know what it's going to be yet, but that's going to be really interesting to watch for, to see, you know, Daisy Ridley and John Boyega and Oscar Isaac and Kelly Marie Tran and whoever else really just unambiguously upped to the center of the story.
Right.
Yeah, and then we're also getting this whole trilogy of movies from Rian Johnson. He's getting his own trilogy. And now, at the risk of getting my expectations up too high again, those are the Star Wars movies that I'm really excited about, because I feel like there could be even more kind of Rian Johnson unleashed, let's break all the, or all, more of the rules of what a Star Wars movie is in that trilogy.
I mean, those are, insofar as we know, and he, this was kind of just announced, so who knows how far, but those are going to be kind of side quills. I mean, they're not going to have the main characters that are going to be kind of, you know, in the contemporary, you know, expanding universe parlance. They're going to be kind of set in the Star Wars world, but he's basically going to be starting from scratch other than that. So it's going to be really interesting to
see
what
he does with
that.
So they'll be kind of analogous to the Rogue One, although not even necessarily using those characters.
Right. That's as far as we know. I mean, you know, they don't exist yet, but that's what they're saying now.
I'm kind of surprised with the smashing critical success, and I'm sure also popular success, which just opened, so we don't know, but I can't imagine this movie won't clean up at the box office. I'm a little bit surprised that he got given this little side quill universe. Why didn't they just hand him number 9?
Reportedly they asked and he said no. But he is, you know, he's been an interesting figure because they had this idea. I wrote about this in the review, but, you know, Lucasfilm, Kathleen Kennedy had this idea, like, let's bring in, like, filmmakers with extensive, Kathleen Kennedy and Lucasfilm had this idea, let's bring in filmmakers with distinctive sensibilities, especially for the kind of spin-off movies, and let them do their own thing. And so they brought in from, you know, the Lego movie, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, and they brought in Gareth Edwards to do Rogue One. And in the middle of both of those movies, they decided they didn't really want those distinctive flavors anymore and, you know, fired them or had them heavily reshot by kind of more compliant hands. And Johnson seems to be someone who has managed to, he's done a lot of great work on TV. In addition to film, he did Ozymandias, which is basically the best episode of Breaking Bad ever. You know, he seems to be able to kind of square that circle and express
himself. Which episode of Breaking Bad was that?
It's kind of the one that feels like the finale, where the last glimpse where he's kind of has the big blowout with Skyler and everything kind of comes to a head.
There's the huge, that's the one with the huge shootout at the end where Hank gets shot, I believe.
Oh, Jesus Christ. That is an amazing episode. I didn't know it was a Rian Johnson production.
Yeah. So it actually kind of makes sense that he's being given his own, you know, kind of pocket universe to play with in here, because he, you know, he is someone who has been very good at creating his own thing within an established framework. And it's obviously very limiting when you have, I mean, there's so much more pressure on, like, how are we going to wrap up these stories and, like, finishing the trilogy. And I can see why he might not want to do that two movies in a row, but it'll be interesting to see how he kind of, you know, invents within it.
Yeah, I have to say this is the most excited I've been about the Star Wars universe probably ever, including when I was 11 and saw the very first one.
Wow.
Wouldn't go that far.
Not to say these movies are better, but I think I'm ready for it now. You know, I clearly remember seeing that very first Star Wars in the summer, you know, when everyone was so excited about it and thinking like, yeah, it's kind of for kids. For kids. That's really what I thought, even at age 11.
Sure.
Before we go, I want to tell you about another podcast on the Panoply Network. It is Slate's Culture Gabfest. And this is a bit awkward because this is, of course, my show that I've appeared on every week for the past 10 years. But if you happen to be one of those people who for some reason listens to the spoiler special and doesn't already know about the Slate Culture Gabfest, it's 3, 2, 1. And doesn't know about the Slate Culture Gabfest, it's a weekly discussion of three cultural topics of the week with me, the Slate, I don't know what you'd call him, critic at large, Stephen Metcalf, and our editor-in-chief, Julia Turner. We all meet to talk about the latest films, television, podcasts, memes, articles, cultural phenomena, whatever comes across our desks that week. For example, on our last episode, we talked about the movie I, Tonya, about the TV show The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and the New Yorker short story that went viral over the weekend, Cat Person. I don't want to talk up my show too much, so will you guys give a little plug? Why should people listen to the Slate Culture Gabfest?
I mean, one of the things I really like about the Gabfest is I feel like you guys do a great balance of kind of talking about the things that I'm already thinking about and interested in hearing about, and then talking about things that I completely didn't know were out there and have never heard of. And I think that's, you know, especially for someone as, you know, forcibly plugged into the culture stream as I am, I mean, that's a really great, like, balance. I mean, I kind of get to feel like I'm in conversation with you guys and also just straight up learn stuff.
Oh, good. That makes me feel like we're doing something right with our topic choice, because every week it's a scramble, like that balance between the big stuff and the small stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to embarrass you here, Dana, because I've been listening to the Culture Gap Fest for 10 years. And in fact, it's in many ways the reason I am at Slate, because I loved the Culture Gab Fest. I mean, I was a Slate reader as well, but I applied to be the intern with the Culture Gab Fest because it was my favorite podcast. And
you were our first intern. You took us from scrambling desperately and not even realizing we needed an intern to giving us structure and sense.
I tried, but this is not about embarrassing me, Dana. It's about embarrassing you. So yeah, I mean, it's great. It's like the spoiler special, but there's a bigger variety, and also there's more kind of talking about the bigger picture surrounding a topic. It's less looking things up on Wikipedia and more like making grand socio-cultural and historical readings about each of those things.
Well, we try. It's fun. We have a good conversation every week, and we've been doing it. It's coming on 10 years now. Next Earth Day, because I remember our very first show was on the week of Earth Day, will be our 10-year anniversary. So if you don't already listen to the Slate Culture Gabfest, please give us a listen next time you can. It is, of course, on your Slate feed or anywhere you get your podcasts. All right, guys, thanks so much. And definitely the next time there's any sort of iteration of Star Wars-ness, I want you both in, along with Wikipedia open on Sam's computer to help me wade through it. So I hope you'll come in and talk again then.
Thank you.
Can't wait. Thanks, Dana.